Yes, thank you. Yes, from my title, you have a good guess. We've already had a good talk this morning from a frightening talk with an excellent talk from Johannes Rockström talking about what we're doing to our planet and the difficulties of that. And so because of that, I thought I would change my approach rather and go talking about variability and change and focus initially on the weather climate problem, which is my background, and show you some of the development in this and the reason that we're really at the start of something, I think, which is really very big and new. And if we think about the prediction of weather and climate, prediction has been at the center of weather and climate and driven the science. And it's actually driven it as a global operation all the time because everyone has realized they need to share data and indeed practices. But over the period of the previous, from the 1980s, the emphasis was on the weather forecast from around a day and extending that up to around a week. A little bit of activity on the seasonal timescale, and then the climate change issue and discussing what that might mean. But the agenda is moving now to consider the spectrum, what I like to call the seamless weather climate prediction problem, where we now think of the whole scale. This is driven from a number of ways. One is the applications, maybe within the day, actually knowing about the severe thunderstorm. In Africa, as we've heard, a lot of the dependence might be on having a good or helpful prediction on the timescale of a week, a month, or a season, rather than thinking about climate change. And if one is dealing with the infrastructure, thinking about how that might need to be built, one's thinking on the decadal or multi-decadal timescale. So we need to fill in this gap if we possibly can. And it has the advantage, too, that in climate change, most of that change will feel itself through the extreme events, so the extreme weather. So if the climate model is not able to give you an indication of that, it's not going to really help you know what the climate might be like. So that's the challenge. And then one of the things to say this is a hopeless prediction problem is the ideas of chaos. But we also do have phenomena that occur on all these timescales. And those phenomena give you the hope of some predictive power when you start to understand how they work and be able to produce a life cycle or else their rather stationary behavior. And equally then on the longer timescales, we have the atmospheric composition, the greenhouse gases being added, the ozone depleting chemicals, volcanoes giving an effect for the next few years, and land use change again associated with our activities, and variations in solar input. So there are external measures, or to a certain extent external factors, which will influence the predictive power. If we are going to make these predictions, then we started off with weather, thinking about the regional atmosphere, and then on the 1 week timescale that had to become global. Then the ocean was involved, first the skin of the ocean, then the upper layers of the ocean, then the full ocean, then the land with its moisture and its dynamic vegetation interacting, the chemistry of the atmosphere, and then the dynamics of ice sheets. So depending on the time scale, one has to consider more and more of the Earth system. So if we think about these challenges and how they're starting to be met, the horizontal resolution of models, when they're solving the equations of fluid dynamics and the equations of thermodynamics for the one-day timescale now down to a kilometer or increasingly so. On the global scale for a week, using a grid of 20 kilometers, climate's still at 100 kilometers at best, but we know to resolve the weather it should really be down to 20 kilometers. And then maybe 100 levels in the vertical and resolving right up to 50 kilometers in the atmosphere. So a huge challenge in the computational problem. And I've already mentioned the breadth of the Earth system that needs to be represented. Even if one's interest is only climate, I say only climate, one has to consider so much of the system. Then representing unresolved processes, whether it's radiative transfer, clouds, you name it, And increasingly, people are beginning to realize those should have a stochastic element to them, those parameterizations. Huge amount of observational data of all sorts, mostly assimilated now in the context of models and used to initialize those models. Handling or giving information on uncertainties. These days, weather forecasts, you don't just get one realization of the next week, you maybe get 50. And it's increasingly realized for the longer timescales and the shorter, we should be having perhaps hundreds of ensemble members to guide the uncertainty and the handling of that. And then the longer timescales, if we're really going to trust models thinking about future changes, we really should be able to simulate the past ones, but those really stretch. The data is starting to be available, and maybe the computational power to really see if we can handle transitions that came in the past. Underneath all this, it's not just technology and making models, it's actually understanding those phenomena that give the potential predictability and also the impact. And to mention again, those impacts are often through extremes and transitions. Can the models handle those? At the moment, they're a real problem. And the wider context of, we've heard this morning, of food, health, energy needs, biodiversity, water, and society is demanding answers of a very young science that society says it can't wait. I wanted to give a couple of examples from shorter timescales that are relevant to the things we've seen in the last couple of years. The Pakistan floods of 2010 were those acts of God, unpredictable. Well, certainly, if we look at a four-day forecast for the region shown in blue there, we can see then the observed rainfall for the most intense period and the four-day forecast, which clearly does capture both the region and the intensity of the event. But it's more than that, actually, if we look at a single deterministic model, and on the left axis gives the lag time and the forecast, the lead time, and at the bottom you can see the extreme rainfalls that occurred in that little red box over northwest Pakistan, and there were bursts of rainfall. And on the 2nd of July, the forecast from there captured the extreme rainfall on the 12th of July. For each of those bursts of rainfall, when you see a diagonal line in red, that was actually predictable 2 weeks ahead. Now, that information was not used in any way. However, there was real predictive power there. And often the challenge is both to have that predictive power and to see how we can use it. In fact, there was predictive power on the monthly timescale here that intense events were quite likely. Another example that you've no doubt heard about is the El Nino Southern Oscillation, a coupled variation in the ocean atmosphere system. And I won't go into detail of that, but an index of the El Nino now, and this is taken from last year. And if we look in the first period, the actual index of the El Nino is shown in the blue dots, and a set of ensemble members is shown in red. And in the first period, there was some idea of which way it was going, maybe useful information for some. 3 months later, the information was really very strong, and there was real predictive power there. So there is predictive power on many of these scales. And the final example I wanted to show of that was thinking about surface temperature over the ocean. Over the ocean, because there's almost none over the land here, but on the five-year timescale. And on the left, the skill is coming from things like we know of greenhouse gases, volcanoes that had already exploded, or the ozone depletion. And on the right is what comes from our first attempts to initialize the deep ocean in these models. So there's skill coming from both areas there. Now, if you have skill on the temperature of the North Atlantic, it actually helps you in skill in tropical cyclones in the North Atlantic. And the left-hand picture shows on a one-year timescale, these are all hindcasts, but on a one-year timescale, the observed number of tropical cyclones is in black, and the models, the ensemble mean is given in red, and the range of the ensemble in gray. And the agreement on a one-year timescale is very good. But even on the right-hand side, on a five-year timescale, there is actually good predictive power for the number of tropical cyclones in the North Atlantic. Thinking of the longer timescales, we've already seen the CO2 picture. I thought I'd better put it in case it hadn't been shown, but it has. But what about what happens to the CO2 as it reaches the atmosphere? There's been an increasing realization in the last decade that once we put CO2 into the atmosphere, an example here of an impulsive addition to the atmosphere of CO2, within the first panel in 100 years, you use a little bit to the upper ocean and the terrestrial biosphere. Then it takes the next 1,000 years for the deep ocean to take up more. And to get beyond that, we're in hundreds of thousands of years. So on our timescales, when we add CO2 to the atmosphere, it basically stays there. And that means that really our targets in terms of greenhouse gas emissions should be a cumulative carbon target, because that is what will actually give the future climate of our planet, unless we can work out how to get negative emissions. So thinking of the last IPCC then, you've no doubt seen the globally average temperatures produced by the last IPCC assessment. I only want to emphasize a couple of points here. One is that in the first 30 years, all the scenarios keep together, but they're all very smooth compared with the past. And that's because these models were not trying to get the decadal variability. They were only looking at the long term and smoothing out any decadal variability. And then I want to emphasize the uncertainty. You see the bars on the right-hand side. And the sort of scenario we're on at the moment is the green or red one. I'm unfortunately second or third to the right. And those have a huge range from maybe 1.5 degrees to maybe 5 degrees above where we were in 2000. A huge range of uncertainty. And if we look at the end of the century on that green scenario there, this shows what the average of the models gives for the change in temperature in December, January, February. So the overall temperature rise, according to the models, was about 3 degrees. On the continents, that means more like 4 degrees. On the northern continents, it means more like 8 degrees. In the permafrost region, 8 degrees temperature rise. Now, that's a pretty stark picture. If you look at the temperature gradients, they actually will be very different as well. And that means all the weather will be different too. However, the models are very smooth in their behavior. The sort of transitions that Johan Rockström was talking about and that we know complex dynamical systems do, don't seem to be reflected in these models that are very much trained and developed in today's climate. So maybe this is the best we can hope for. And of course, the precipitation would change as well. We have confidence from basic physical principles that heavy rainfall events are likely to become more heavy, and also that the drier regions will tend to become drier. But please don't look at the detail, because at the moment it is really uncertain. Just to emphasize the way the climate models are becoming more like Earth system models, to put dynamic life into a climate model, that vegetation plays the crucial role in terms of exchanges of energy at the surface of the Earth, exchanges in water, and then the crucial role in the carbon cycle, and the whole dynamics of the vegetation as it interacts, and then, of course, on top, we have land use change. All this has to be represented if we're to actually get confidence in where our climate is going. I wanted to also just mention Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet loss, which is another of the big aspects of unknowns, but perhaps is proceeding worse than we had hoped. On the left-hand side, a little schematic of Greenland, and there is now a realization that the warm ocean actually undercutting in both Antarctica and Greenland on the edge is probably playing a crucial role. So from the mass balance of Greenland or Antarctica, and in the latter time from satellite measurements based on gravity, satellite gravity measurements, the right-hand graphs show then an idea of the mass balance of Greenland and Antarctica in the last period. First, you see that the gravity measurements and the mass balance estimates tend to agree. And secondly, you see the decline in Greenland of the mass and also in Antarctica, perhaps more surprising. And together they now contribute about 1 millimeter per year to sea level rise. So that's probably about a third of the total sea level rise, which is the order of 3 millimeters per year at the moment. which is 30 centimeters per decade, but we do see this acceleration. So I'm going to bring my talk to an end here. I hope I've given you an idea now of coming through from the weather climate of our ability to understand, simulate, predict in this seamless weather climate system. It's developing well, and there are many challenges ahead, but I think there are many opportunities here. But I did want to emphasize that the Earth systems science and the predictions also include many other aspects. For instance, I've shown a picture on the right, which was prediction from Monday of the ozone distribution at lunchtime today, at least what I thought would be lunchtime. So lunchtime today around the world. And that's assimilating all the observations in real time in the context of a model and then predicting these out. And of course, that's the sort of air quality information we'll need for the end of the century as well. We've heard about ecosystem variability. Let me emphasize again, variability as well as a change. We're always looking at the combination of the two. And it's often the extremes that go with the variability along with the change that are so important. And then I put in a picture of the nitrogen cycle. Just that's what we're doing to the coastal ocean in terms of the nitrogen sources and sinks. It just took off in 1940 as the sources and sinks. So just to conclude then, we have a lot of ability that is developing. There's a real crescendo in ability to predict important information, applicable information, and we can do that. However, there is also a great urgency about that need because society needs what we can provide. Thank you.